From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump announced his pick to lead the FBI on Twitter this morning. It's Christopher Wray, a former assistant attorney general who Trump calls a man of impeccable credentials. Wray led the Justice Department's criminal division from 2003 to 2005 during George W. Bush's administration. Joining us now is NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi, Phil.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. And first of all, tell us more about Christopher Wray.
Well, Christopher Wray is apparently an uncontroversial nominee. He's gotten some early support here in Washington from both Democrats and Republicans. Some of Trump's earlier nominees early in the administration involved some big battles in the Senate, especially with Democrats who are concerned about their politics or about their qualifications. Wray, as you mentioned, was a Justice Department attorney for a long time. And one of the things he did back in the old days was run the Enron task force. If people remember the big Enron scandal of the Bush administration era. That was called the most complicated white-collar matter the FBI and the Justice Department ever handled, and he was the guy in charge of that, which is why the president has expressed so much confidence in him in that tweet you mentioned from this morning. Now he's an attorney in private practice, and if he's confirmed by the Senate, Trump would bring him back into government to run the FBI.
And one more thing about him, he represented Chris Christie, right, in the Bridgegate scandal.
That's right. So he's had a connection with another figure in Trump's orbit, although the connections between Trump and Christie are not as close as they used to be back in the campaign context.
Right. Well, that leads us to why Wray is being nominated at all, and it's because James Comey was fired as director of the FBI last month. Comey is set to speak publicly tomorrow morning for the first time since he was fired by President Trump on May 9th. He's going to be speaking to the Senate Intelligence Committee. What are you expecting?
Well, I don't know if former Director Comey, can live up to the hype that's being put on him in Washington, especially on the cable networks. You know, you've seen they've had these countdown clocks counting down to the day when he gets his first question from those committee members. But what he's expected to say is a version of the story that has been told in leaked accounts and documents in the Washington Post and New York Times, that as FBI director, President Trump may have asked him to ease up on former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, whom Trump had to let go early in the administration over his statements he made inside the White House about his connections to Russia's ambassador. Once Comey has said that for the record in the open in public or a version of that, that will be a pretty potent weapon for Trump's opponents to use in what they say may have been a case in which the president tried to obstruct justice. There are also accounts that say Trump asked other top intelligence bosses, Dan Coats, the director of National Intelligence, Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the National Security Agency, and the director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, might have been mixed up in this as well, according to the Washington Post. And if Comey lays the brick to build that case, that could be a very big deal politically for Democrats and opponents.
Is there any expectation of fireworks that Comey is really going to go after President Trump?
You know, Comey's camp, through very careful management of the press and networks and wire services, has really tried to tamp down expectations about that. We don't expect him, according to these reports, to make any kind of legal or law enforcement charge against the president about obstructing justice. What Comey's camp told ABC News is he wants to be a fact witness, as lawyers might say. He wants to be a guy who gives information and instead leaves the conclusions or analysis to others. And so if he may not make an explosive political charge, he may at least say, for example, whether he did or did not tell Trump that Trump was not under investigation by the FBI, as President Trump claimed was the case at the time when he fired Comey last month.
One of the things that's been reported about Trump and Comey's relationship and something that made Trump angry is the clip we're about to play when Comey testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in May. And he was asked and talked about whether he did the right thing in revealing 11 days before the election that the FBI was reopening the Clinton email investigation. Let's listen.
Look, this is terrible. It makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. But honestly, it wouldn't change the decision. Everybody who disagrees with me has to come back to October 28th with me and stare at this and tell me what you would do. Would you speak or would you conceal?
Now, Trump praised his decision at the time, but the president has since tried to paint Comey as someone not to be trusted. He called him a grandstander, a showboat. What are the attitudes of Republicans and Democrats toward Comey heading into tomorrow?
It's a very conflicted situation. Democrats blame Comey for costing Hillary Clinton the election last year, and Republicans, until this imbroglio with Trump, had praised him as a stanch supporter of justice and somebody that they could trust to do the right thing in their view, even though the politics involved benefited them. Now the shoes are on the other feet. Democrats want him to be able to give them a case to further hurt the president, to cost him support among borderline people if they can. And Republicans are very wary about this testimony he may give. And I wouldn't be surprised if Republicans at this hearing tomorrow point out that in other appearances that Comey gave to the Senate since the Russia investigations have been taking place, he said there was no pressure put on him to waive off. Or they may ask him, well, if you felt so uncomfortable with this relationship with Trump, why didn't you just go ahead and resign? And why did it come to this crisis with him? Only Jim Comey knows the answer to those questions. And if he's asked about it, it'll be very interesting to see how much he's willing to talk about.
And do we think Trump's going to be tweeting during the hearing?
I think there's probably an excellent chance of that. The last time Comey, or I should say in March when Comey talked, Trump had a whole running commentary going on Twitter.
It's NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
To London now, where police say the death toll in Saturday's attacks has risen to 8. They recovered a body from the Thames, believed to be Xavier Thomas, a Frenchman who'd been walking on London Bridge with his girlfriend when the van driven by the attackers hit them and others. His girlfriend was seriously injured. Meanwhile, authorities are facing questions about warning signs about the three men who carried out the attacks. John Sweeney is with BBC Newsnight. And John, start with the man you call the ringleader of the attacks, Khurram Butt.
There were a ton of clues that the police and MI5, our security service, our version of the FBI, if you like, seemed to have overlooked. He was clearly trouble. He would go around his neighbourhood in the East End of London calling out Muslim women who weren't wearing the headscarf, the hijab. He tried to convert non-Muslim children to Islam in a way that alarmed their mums, and one mother went to the police to complain about him. I spoke on Monday to a woman who ran a beauty parlour opposite a gym he used, and she had a row with him, took a picture of his car. This was some weeks ago, but nevertheless, it was this car which the police took away on Monday. And he was a member of an organisation that's been banned in Britain for quite a while, but it still kind of exists under the radar, called Al Mujahiroon.
Well, in fact, this Khurram Butt was seen in a documentary about extremists, in a video. He was seen using an ISIS flag. We understand there's outrage that Khurram Butt was known and this happened, but also that Youssef Zagba, who was 22, the New York Times reports, he was arrested in Italy on his way to Syria to fight for ISIS. He was released. So what's been the response from officials to how much was known?
Here's the problem. MI5 has got a long list of potential jihadi terrorists with 23,000 names on it. The short list has 3,000 names on it. They're looking at 500 active possible plots right now.
Boy, a list of 23,000 and then another list, more refined, more suspicious people of 3,000. Britain's relatively small. This is huge.
This is a terrible problem, the scale of which we are only now coming to terms with. And there is no easy solution, and there is no solution in sight to the scale of the problem. In fact, look at it the other way around. We've been very lucky, and to be fair to to MI5 and the police, the counter-terrorism officials and the police, they have thwarted more than a dozen plots in the last few years. One possible explanation why we've had a rash of three of these events in the last 3 months is that the other side, the jihadis, have learned not to use the internet, because however secretive and clever and enciphered the technology is, if you go truly off radar, then the authorities lose sight of you. And perhaps that is the explanation for what's happened. Yeah. They're doing all of this off the internet.
Just very, very briefly, John Sweeney, this is ahead of tomorrow's election with Prime Minister Theresa May looking to get a vote of support for her government and the plans for Brexit, for leaving the EU. How is this affecting tomorrow's election?
The essential argument is about trust. Theresa May started with an enormous opinion poll lead, and that's come down. The opinion poll suggests that she's going to win, but with a much smaller majority than everybody thought. To be fair to the Labour challenger, Jeremy Corbyn, he's had a much better campaign than everybody thought, because he's had questions about his, in the past he's been very left-wing and questioned how Britain has fought IRA terrorists, for example, and he's managed to kind of neutralise that. So the essential thing is, who do you trust most to be Prime Minister? That's a great question. Fingers crossed there'll be no bombs, no attacks, no terror incidents tomorrow, and we can get on with the job of voting without any more trauma.
John Sweeney of the BBC Newsnight programme. John, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow at the crack of dawn, sailors, rowers, paddlers will cast off from Port Townsend, Washington on a 750-mile marathon journey up the fabled Inside Passage to Ketchikan, Alaska. It's the third edition of the annual Race to Alaska, and the rules are simple. All craft must be human-powered. So sailboats, kayaks, and this year for the first time, stand-up paddleboarders. Tom Bonsi of Here and Now contributor Northwest News Network starts our look with three paddlers.
There's some really big water between here and Alaska,
and
the paddleboard is not very protected. Can it be done safely?
Yeah, I definitely feel that it can be done safely.
That's paddleboarder Erdogan Kirak of Bellingham, Washington. He entered the Race to Alaska on the urging of his friend Luke Burritt. They plan to paddle together the entire course, all 750 miles, on separate 17.5-foot boards.
We don't want to die. I mean, of course, what we are doing is a little nutty, but no, we're not looking at dying.
Burritt says he was inspired to try something no one has achieved before on a paddleboard.
My life kind of is adventure. I've immersed myself in it, climbing guide and paddleboard instructor who lives in a van. That is what I do. I kind of live for being outdoors and the adventure.
The Race to Alaska has two basic rules: no motors and no support crews. A race co-founder once compared the Maritime Marathon to the Iditarod sled dog race, but with a chance of drowning, or being eaten by a bear, or run over by a freighter. The custom-built paddleboards Burritt and Kirak will stand aboard look like surfboards that have been stretched to be longer and narrower.
Like I said, we've got 28 tie-downs over the entire thing, but this is our main tie-down location for our forward gear.
Which includes lightweight dry suits, one water filter, mosquito-proof hammocks, bear spray, just in case, and 3 to 4 days of food at a time.
We're also planning on trying to do as much scavenging and foraging as we can.
For seaweed or shellfish. The heavy swells in the Columbia River Gorge east of Portland, Oregon, is one of the places where they trained.
You're paddling, 50 feet from your buddy, and all of a sudden you're like, where'd he go? Because one of the swells didn't swallow him up, but is too tall and you just can't see over it. And it's super fun to go do something like that. And you have the right equipment on, so you do feel safe.
Kirak declined to estimate a race finish time, other than to say the team aims to average about 35 miles per day. That means they're not in it for the $10,000 top prize or the second place award of a set of steak knives. There is a third paddleboarder entered in the race. Carl Kruger of Orcas Island, Washington, is making his second solo attempt at the Race to Alaska. He plans to sustain himself mainly on high-calorie food pellets, along with some protein shakes and energy bars and gels. Race to Alaska co-founder Jake Beattie says the organizers carefully vetted the seafaring skills of the stand-up paddleboarders and the crews of a few other even smaller craft in the race.
Generally, we have a high degree of skepticism around paddleboarders. In fact, when we were starting this race 3 years ago, we looked at each other and said, well, one thing's for sure, we're never going to let a paddleboard into the race. And this year, of course, we let three in.
This year's Race to Alaska has 41 entries in all. A colorful assortment of additional sail and human-powered craft joined the flotilla for the initial qualifying segment, now dubbed the Proving Ground, from Port Townsend to Victoria, Canada. The starting gun fires at dawn's early light tomorrow. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
Well, this year, a team of Race to Alaska competitors is made up of the Bird Brothers of Marblehead, Massachusetts, Tripp, Chris, and Trevor. Now, Chris and Tripp raced in 2015 on an open catamaran and came in fourth overall. A short documentary was made about their sometimes harrowing voyage.
Each day brought a new adventure. Massive kelp beds that stopped them dead in the water. Howling winds that eventually took their toll, ripping their jib apart and breaking their boom. They were stuck in a frustrating rhythm, sail, break, stop, relying on their own ingenuity and the kindness of strangers, when they could find them, to help them repair and try again.
And despite that, they're doing it again, with younger brother Trevor, who's off preparing. So Tripp and Chris join us by Skype from the dock in Port Townsend. Tripp, you there?
I am.
What we're hoping to do is check in with you along the way. But really, when we hear that, you know, the boom broke at one point, massive kelp beds stop you in your tracks. Why are you doing it again?
There's nothing else like it. Although, you know, all of us are very experienced in the ocean. We do a lot of sailboat racing, and there's no other challenge we found that connects all the levels of, you know, competitiveness, but also adventure and exploring new areas.
And last year you had a 22-foot beach catamaran. What about this year?
Yeah, last year was pretty cold. This year we've got something a little bit bigger, and it has some downstairs. We've got a little double-wide coffin with a stove set up, and being able to tuck in out of the wind and waves is going to be convenient.
Well, I mentioned you were the fourth overall, but you were the first boat to come in that had no protection on board. And as you say at one point in the film, I'm wearing everything I own. Well, Chris, I wanted to ask, we saw before the last race, you spoke to a tribal shaman.
If your boat doesn't get you to where it needs to go, then you've offended it in some way. You listen to your boat, and talking to her would be a very normal thing to do.
She was telling you the boat is alive. She suggested you make offerings. Are you following that advice this year?
You know, I think we are. I think we have our smudge sticks ready to go. And I think there really is a connection with the boat and with the conditions. And, you know, you kind of have to play the cards that you're given. It's really how you adapt to those. It does come down to kind of what the boat wants to do.
Do you say things to the boat?
You're going to embarrass me here. Yes, we definitely talk to the boat. I think, you know, as part of our ceremony beforehand, we learned what was called the seal song. I'm not going to sing that right now, but it's definitely, I would say, common to talk to the boat a little bit, specifically in tougher areas on the course.
Right. Tripp, what was the most spectacular thing you saw?
Most spectacular thing, there was a couple times that we were just, after several days of really, really challenging conditions, crazy wind and waves that were, you know, hammering you back every time they hit. And then a moment would come along where everything sort of fell in your favor and you were cranking along, making, you know, good pace towards the finish, and everything just sort of balanced out and was working well. That was the best moment. Other times where you come across whales or bioluminescence in the water, and just everything was pretty magical.
We should say, I mean, yes, you're sailing, you know, under your own power, but you have Skype and you have GoPro cameras and you can, you know, talk to crews on the land. Did you ever think of just stripping everything away?
Absolutely. The lighter you are, the faster you are. So getting rid of all that removes a lot of weight and also a lot of hassle. But at the same time, being able to share the story with friends, family, whatever, and also to remember it by is a pretty cool tool to have on board. It's worth the small penalty.
Well, and as you and all the racers are told at the beginning, you're on your own. I mean, if something happens, somebody may not be able to get to you.
The Canadian Coast Guard comes in and gives a warning the day before the start and makes it pretty clear, you know, it's not so much you call the cops and they come get you. It's several days before a rescue boat can make it to your position. So it does put things in perspective a little bit.
So hold on to your phone. and we should have a little disclosure here. Your mom is my college roommate, the fabulous Jean Verbridge. Your dad, Charles Bird, just passed away as you were planning on going on this trip after an illness way too young. Did you boys ever think,
well, we can't go, or, you know, how did that, how does that factor into this?
It's been a tough month for the Bird family, Bird Brothers, but it's something that he got a lot of pride out of, seeing us do what we loved and seeing us, you know, all sort of get along and bond together as a family. So, I don't know, it was never a consideration that we weren't going to go. It makes it extra special.
I'm wondering, Chris, if this is maybe some kind of rite of passage for the three of you, something maybe even more powerful.
Yeah, I mean, the three of us have never really sailed together before, and it's always something that Dad's been really proud of and kind of what we've done. So I think for us, it's been, you know, really a moment for us to all sail together, and something that we know we're all excited about. But more importantly, I think it's something he was excited about.
Well, he will be the wind beneath your sails there, and we are going to check back in with you. So stay safe, okay?
We'll try.
Okay. Chris and Trip.
The fine line.
Yeah. Trip and Chris Bird, with their brother Trevor, they are racing to Alaska, the 750-mile non-motor-powered race from Port Townsend, Washington, to Ketchikan, Alaska, through the fabled Inside Passage. See you guys.
Hey, thanks. We'll talk soon.
On Wall Street, some are calling tomorrow Super Thursday, with three big events that could shake things up. Former FBI Director James Comey's testimony on Capitol Hill, the British elections, and a big meeting of the European Central Bank. Joining us now is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the Comey testimony. What are the markets watching for there?
Well, first, if you step back and just look at the markets this year, it's been an amazingly tranquil, calm market. So that sort of explains why traders are getting a little bit giddy, honestly, about the possibility of gyrations in markets tomorrow. Because the one really exceptionally volatile day this year, markets dropped almost 2%, was after the New York Times reported on Comey's memos that documented how President Trump had said he hoped the Russian investigation would go away. And that really marked an interesting turning point in the market's assessment of the situation. Obviously, investors had seemed to be willing to say innocent until proven guilty when it comes to the Russian probe. But this possibility of obstruction of justice had suddenly become a more acute threat to the markets. So this week, obviously, there's been some reports that Comey is going to stop short of saying he obstructed, that Trump obstructed justice. But who really knows what else he'll have to say, especially now that he's a private citizen. So I think that's why most of Wall Street will be glued to this testimony.
Well, and the implication is that if this is really damaging to the White House, that the president's agenda would be in trouble. And specifically, I think when we're talking about what markets are worried about, it's the tax cut package.
Yeah, mainly the tax cut, and also the deregulation push as well is very popular with stock investors.
Although the markets do get things wrong sometimes, and I'm thinking about the night that the Brexit news came out and election night when the markets were just all over the place because what they had bet on was wrong.
Right. That's exactly right.
So the other thing that's happening tomorrow is the British elections, and now it looks like a real chance that Labour could win and that Jeremy Corbyn could be the prime minister.
Yeah, the polls have quite tightened quite a bit. I mean, I think Theresa May and the Conservatives are still out in the lead pretty well, but those polls have really tightened enough that it makes you wonder what would happen if Labour does make inroads. And the general notion is that the Labour Party in Britain would be more open to bigger government spending, higher deficits, and that would lead to higher interest rates in Britain, maybe some weakness in the pound. But there's sort of a more troubling scenario that some traders are worried about, and that's basically a hung parliament where no one gets the majority. And that would really drag out these Brexit negotiations. And that, from a trader's perspective, that's probably the bigger risk to the markets if that were to happen.
And what about the third thing that makes this Super Thursday, and that is the meeting of the European Central Bank? What are people expecting there?
Well, obviously, the economic outlook in Europe has improved pretty strongly this year. So the question is, when will the ECB under Mario Draghi begin to really aggressively tighten the stimulus measures? Just like the Federal Reserve, not only have they kept interest rates super low, but they've also been buying bonds to sort of help keep interest rates low and stimulate the economy. And reversing that, normalizing, as they call it, is it's obviously a process that is fraught with peril
right.
if it's done in a way that's perceived to be too hasty. So the market's going to be keeping an eye on Mario Draghi to see how he handles that tomorrow.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, talking to us about a lot of stuff happening tomorrow in the markets. Mike, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Major American companies have rejected President Trump's plan to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. Even carbon-emitting oil giants say that a warming planet has altered the global economy and that lessening the risk of that warming is good business. In southern Louisiana, erosion, sea level rise, and powerful storms threaten ports, pipelines, oil wells as that state's coastline is vanishing. In his series this week from Louisiana, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd explains how industry is looking for solutions of its own.
The buzz of commerce is on full display at the southern tip of Louisiana, and Sarah Mack is trying to protect it.
So we're actually right across from Port Fouchon by Lafourche.
There's like big old ships in front of us.
Big old ships is kind of an understatement. These are massive ships that serve the oil and gas offshore industry.
Mack is a scientist and founder of the wetland restoration company Tierra Resources. She spends a lot of time plying this shallow marsh on her 24-foot boat. Mack drops anchor. We pull big rubber waders up to our hips and jump in. We're just a few hundred yards from the Gulf of Mexico.
Ooh, just sunk. Hold on.
This is actually really solid, good walking for wetlands.
I can tell.
The water is already comfortably warm. As the summer draws on, it will be the fuel for powerful hurricanes that could wipe out the nearby port, which services 90% of the Gulf's offshore oil industry. Mack is leading me toward the shore to show me something that could mitigate a disaster. It's an unassuming plant called the black mangrove, which is increasingly common here.
These mangroves are actually a tropical species. And because the climate is warming and we're not getting these hard freezes, these tropical plants are moving into the southern reaches of Louisiana.
By now, we're out of the water, trudging through a mangrove thicket that belongs to ConocoPhillips. The oil company owns 640,000 acres in southern Louisiana, making it the largest private wetland owner in the country.
This sounds like a muddy job you have.
You're covered in mud by the time it's all said and done.
Fleshy mangrove tubes stick up from the mud and trip us up. Mack and a scientist she works with named Robert Lane from Louisiana State University say those tubes are called pneumatophores.
They're the root system, but they're also what sticks up out of the water so that the plant can actually take oxygen.
All mangroves have some sort of pneumatophore.
That's what you want this. This is good. This is going to protect from storm surge.
Yeah. This will hold the wetlands together and not dissipate.
Since the 1930s, Louisiana has lost more than 1,900 square miles of land to erosion. That's the size of Delaware. Blame the oil companies for much of it. For decades, they've dug a system of canals through the fragile marsh to access their wells. Climate change and sea rise are compounding the problem. Mack says losing the land means losing a buffer from powerful storm surge.
What really happens with a surge is you get this big wall of water. With Hurricane Katrina, it was 28 feet. And then you also have the waves on top of the water. So it really can cause massive destruction to levee systems, like in Hurricane Katrina, massive flooding.
By some estimates, it'll take $90 billion in the next 50 years to restore the coast, and private industry will have to help. For the past several years, Sarah Mack and Robert Lane have tested a theory. What if you collect a bunch of mangrove seeds known as propagules and replant them across tens of thousands of acres?
In general, along the Louisiana coast, you see mangroves along the bayou edges, and that's because the propagules flow along with the water and they get stranded along the edges and they can't get further into the interior. And it's an interior marsh that we're trying to establish these mangroves in.
You want them to go deeper than just the
edges. Yeah, and so that's what the airplane can do.
The airplane?
That sound is from a video taken last fall. Mac hired a crop duster to drop plane loads of mangrove seeds deep into a salt marsh where only fragile grasses had grown before. Several months later, Mac is reaching into the marsh with a ruler to show me how the seeds have come to life. What are you looking at? You've got these little, oh my gosh, it's tiny.
Yeah, those are our growing mangrove seedlings from what we seeded just this past November.
It's buried in the grass here.
Yeah, but you can see I'm measuring this. This is 10 inches, and this has grown 10 inches since November.
This is a pretty big piece of land that we're standing on, but in the scheme of things, it's actually pretty small if you consider how widespread this problem is. So is it realistic to think that what you're doing here could be replicated on a scale that would be large enough to actually make a difference?
So that's what we're specifically working on now. Our goal is to seed 30,000 acres in the next 10 years because we know probably a quarter of that will be lost that we won't get to in time.
Is 30,000 acres even enough?
I mean, nothing's ever quite enough, but everything helps. Again, when our trade-off is open water, every bit helps.
And open water is a threat to companies like ConocoPhillips. The oil giant is Mac's main investor, and it's given her permission to plant seeds on its land. The company wouldn't tape an interview with me, but I did speak with another investor that's paid Tierra Resources more than $600,000 in recent years.
We are at the boundary between St. Bernard Parish and Plaquemines Parish in southeast Louisiana.
Okay.
Right on the banks of the Mississippi River. This area was 100% flooded after Katrina.
Rick Johnson is Director of Environmental Strategy and Policy for Entergy, an electric utility that serves several southern states. We're just outside of New Orleans, where he says part of its business was forced into bankruptcy 12 years ago after Hurricane Katrina.
Entergy years ago realized that climate change was a risk to not just our assets, but to also to the customers we serve, be they residential, commercial, industrial customers, to the regions where we operate. We recognize that sea level rise and coastal erosion were risks to those assets, not just our company assets, but communities and all of our customers.
When you're talking about a risk to your assets, mm-hmm. what do you mean specifically?
I mean specifically, as an example, during Hurricane Katrina, one of our power plants in the eastern part of New Orleans took on a very large storm surge that basically shut that plant down for months while it had to be restored.
And we're not that far away from there right
now.
That's
right. That's right.
Okay, so that's one. You have power plants mm-hmm. that when the storm surge comes in, that water wipes out a power plant.
Yeah.
You have transmission lines.
We have transmission lines, which during several storms over the last 15 years, we experienced major breaks in those transmission lines, cutting off part of our customer base from the power grid.
You were telling me that one of the assets that is important to you also is your customers. You need customers in order to be a profitable business. And you have firsthand experience with this, right? I mean, when Katrina came through, a lot of your customers left and your business suffered.
It did suffer.
Tell me a little bit more about that. What happened? People just moved away, didn't pay their bills or what?
Well, people moved away, couldn't accept power, weren't paying their bills because they weren't, the meters weren't turning.
The company says that by 2030, environmental threats could cause $350 billion worth of damage to Gulf Coast infrastructure. But its investment in Tierra Resources and other restoration projects will not be enough to solve the problem. In fact, local parishes have sued big oil companies, demanding they pay more to restore the land they've had a role in degrading. Back on the bayou near Port Fouchon, Sarah Mack says it's an all-hands-on-deck kind of a problem.
The government is so slow, and this is a dire emergency.
Her boat is at the edge of the grassy marsh, where waves crash gently but ceaselessly against the shore.
And then if you look right here down to our right, you'll see how we have all these PVC poles are just sticking out in the water.
Yep.
So we marked the edge of this site. This was only a year ago.
Oh my gosh.
That we marked the edge of this site.
So we're talking about lost land. Those PVC pipes used to be at the edge of the land?
Yes.
So the one that we're closest to right now is at least 6 feet from land now. It's just sitting out there in the water by itself.
Yeah, so these are 1 year of erosion, and this is probably about a year and a half.
sort of a microcosm of what's happening all through here.
Yeah, and this is a more protected site. This is not bad erosion.
At this point, the mangroves she's planted are just barely peeking above the grass, still far from the encroaching water. The question is, will they be strong enough to keep the land together as the waves close in? For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Summer fish soups are on today's menu with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who's here with us in the studio. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Jeremy. Hello, Robin.
I'll just be eating over here.
Okay. We won't bother you.
Well, Kathy, hot soup is not usually a go-to summer food, I must say.
It's not what you think of first, but think of chowder and summers by the shore and all of that fabulous shellfish and seafood. And there's a real precedent in a lot of hot weather climates, Vietnam, Thailand, throughout Southeast Asia, hot soups, and India as well. They are used as ways to cool down. In hot weather. Not necessarily even spicy foods, but just the heat of the soup. And these are perfect, like, one-dish dinners for the summer. Sitting outside, cold beer, bottle of rosé, and any one of these soups.
Well, they are perfect. You could end the sentence with perfect, because Jeremy and I have tried all three. We've been eating them.
I'll take perfect.
And these are clear, by the way. These aren't a chowder, as you say, like a milk base. Yeah, these are clear.
I mean, chowder is the classic, you know, throughout New England, Manhattan, Rhode Island, but these are not chowders. They have no dairy. Which do you want to start with?
Well, you got clams here.
Okay, so Robin started over there. That is the simplest, excuse my voice, allergy season. Mm-hmm. That is the simplest of all of them. That is.
You know what's good for that? Soup.
Soup.
Yes.
Well, so let's anyone want to give me a sip? Oh, I'm sitting over here all alone with no bowl. All I do. No, anyway, that is such an easy soup. You saute onion, garlic, add a chorizo, which is a spicy sausage, out of the casing, let it get nice and brown, throw in some fresh summer tomatoes, little bit of wine, and then you just add clams. And as soon as they open, it's done. And then you sprinkle a good handful of garden arugula on top. So the peppery arugula with the sweet tomato and the clams.
Oh, yeah, my dad used to have a little clammer out in the Great South Bay of Long Island. We'd go get clams. Or you just stand on the beach and you twist your feet and you get quahogs.
Right.
But just for people who are afraid of clams, I mean, if you buy them in a reputable fish place.
That is key. If they don't open, they're not good.
Exactly.
You want to get rid of them. And you also want to scrub them really well or soak them in a bowl of water. Some people add a pinch of cornmeal because they'll open a little bit and spit out their sand. You do that a lot with steamers, but you want to scrub them because there's a lot of sand and grit on them.
Okay.
Okay, so that's one. Let's go to the gray bowl.
Okay.
That is my bouillabaisse-ish soup. I call it a French-style summer fish stew. Mm. This is heaven to me, just smelling it. It's got garlic and shallots and fresh fennel and parsley and basil. And there's a little bit of spice from harissa, which is a Moroccan chili paste. Excuse me. Or you can use tomato paste, white wine, fish stock. And then that's got cod or haddock, little bit of swordfish and or tuna, some fresh shrimp.
So you put a white fish right in here, a cod or a haddock?
I did. Everyone says, well, wait, won't that just flake up and disappear? That's the point. Some of the fish will be solid, like the swordfish or the tuna, but some of the white fish will just crumble up and add texture and flavor to the soup. And then clams at the very end. You could also add mussels or lobster.
Well, I was just going to say, you mentioned that some of these soups come from Southeast Asia. I can just smell that this last one does.
It is, exactly. That is also a very simple soup to make. This has got fresh ginger, lemongrass, lots of lime juice and lime zest, and a bit of Thai red curry paste, coconut milk.
Yeah.
That gives it the creaminess, but it's not heavy. It's got a little bit of rice wine vinegar, shiitake mushrooms, cilantro, and then flounder or snapper or whatever type of firm white fish you have where you live. And then I took some beautiful New England scallops, fresh, and a few shrimp and tons of fresh lime juice at the end.
Boy, the coconut milk and the lime, right, Jeremy? You're in Thailand. You're in Vietnam. It's just
So what do you serve on the side, Kathy?
Not much. You know, seriously, because these are pretty hearty for the summer. So imagine sitting out on a deck eating one of these fish soups. Maybe you have a crusty bread, beautiful summer salad. Not necessarily just greens either. Think about maybe artichokes or steamed or roasted asparagus or grilled vegetables on top of a salad, and you would have a perfect and not complex summer meal.
If you don't make your own stock, how do you feel about canned or bottled
stock?
Good
question. What I feel is my fish store has homemade stock in the freezer that they make. And it is so good. It's $2 for a pint, and it's great. It is very easy to make your own fish stock. You want to ask for a rack, which is like the skeleton of a whitefish in the fish store. You simmer it down. If you're going to use bottled clam juice or bottled fish stock, they are salty. Beware.
Okay.
It will add a lot of sodium.
Okay. Well, delicious.
Delicious. Kathy Gunst, our resident chef.
Sorry, everybody out there.
Well, but you know what? It's not too late for you to go to our website, hereandnow.org, and find the recipes.
And
you can make these yourself. They are absolutely delicious, especially that
coconut.
Thai one.
That's your favorite?
Delicious.
Cool.
Yeah.
Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Were you saying something? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. These are great.